So again, we can start if you'd like with any questions or comments or reports about the practice and the exercises if you've been doing them. Please.
What about meditating, listening to music, or chanting, or anything like that?
So that's a open-ended question. Can you?
Is it okay?
Oh, is it all? It's certainly okay to do that. And some people find it very pleasurable to do that. Some people find it very relaxing and calming to do that. When you're doing mindfulness meditation, it's usually recommended that you don't listen to music or listen to chanting, but rather do the practice without any intentional accompaniment by anything that's going to have any effect on you, because the function of mindfulness meditation is not just to become calm, but rather to develop our own ability to have an independent mindfulness, to have a presence of mind which is independent of any props that help put us in the right condition, in the right, you know, the right state of mind, or something like that. And so when people rely on music, or even when they rely on guided meditations like tapes or whatever, then they're never really developing that ability to be self-reliant on their own. And that's really what we're looking for. And so it's a wonderful thing to do. It's a fine thing to do. But when you do mindfulness meditation, you're encouraged to develop that kind of self-reliant ability that doesn't require anything to happen. Using something like music or guided meditation tapes or whatever supports or reinforces the notion that mindfulness meditation is about getting into a particular state of mind, and that's what many people associate meditation with, is getting in a good state of mind. And but there's no state of mind which is the right state of mind for mindfulness meditation. And so if you're constantly associating mindfulness with a particular state of mind, when that state of mind is not happening, then you compare yourself to that, saying, well, I'm not doing it right, or I can't do it now, or this is not it, or I'll give up today, I'll go play golf instead or something. There's no state of mind which is the point of the practice. The point of the practice is to develop this ability of independent and free awareness, to see clearly what's going on. Is the point, not a particular state of mind. So no matter what's happening, you can always practice clear seeing. And that's what we want to keep developing. So if you're always associating a particular state of mind as being the same as clear seeing, you're misleading yourself. Is that making sense? Yes?
What's meant by right resolve or right intention? What does that mean in practice?
So what prompts you to ask that question?
It's one of the aspects of the Eightfold Way that I don't understand. I don't know what the practical implementation of that would be.
Okay, what he's referring to is that in the traditional spiritual teachings of the Buddha, the Buddhist path is a 8-step program. And it starts with right view or right understanding. Then there's right intention or right resolve, you called it. And then there's three aspects of getting your actions and your behavior in the world aligned in such a way with so that it's supportive of your effort to develop a spiritual life. So you need to develop right speech. And so if you go around lying and being mean to people with your speech, it's very hard to develop the inner sensitivity that one needs to have in order to develop Buddhist spiritual life. So right speech, then right action, which means basically living a moral life, right livelihood, making sure that your livelihood is somehow in line with the spiritual direction you're going. If you're trying to become a person motivated by compassion and free and who's uprooted the motivations of greed and hate, and you're involved with promoting war in the world, selling weapons, the two don't jive together. So the Buddha emphasized you have to kind of look at your livelihood and perhaps you need to reevaluate sometimes what you're doing. And then there was right mindfulness and right concentration. So these are the eightfold path. So his question is, what about right intention, right resolve? He doesn't understand it. Without some intention, there's no spiritual practice. Without some wish or aspiration for some possibility, there's no spiritual practice. Different Buddhist teachers will talk, have a different opinion about what the right view or right resolve is. But without some kind of resolve, there's no practice. Otherwise, you wouldn't sit down, you wouldn't dedicate yourself to mindfulness, you wouldn't... What I like to stress is that one of the things we can use our mindfulness for is for each of us to discover what our own intentions are. What is our own deepest intention? What's the deepest resolves we have for ourselves? And that's something which can be clarified and worked with over time. But many people go through life kind of an automatic pilot and often will take on the values or the agendas that society has for them and just kind of plug away at that without really thinking deeply. What is their heart's deepest wish? So one of the ways to use mindfulness is to really get quiet and still and mindful enough to actually begin investigating what it is for each individual person rather than what Buddhism says. And then from that, and I have a tremendous faith that if we clarify and purify that question of what is our deepest intention, that we'll find our way to the deepest spiritual truths. When the Buddha talked about right intention, he was built upon the first of the Eightfold Path, which is right view. And the right view is the view that understands suffering and the cause of suffering, understands what stress is in our life and how it's possible and what the causes of that stress are. And right resolve is a resolve that tries to bring an end to that suffering or that stress. That's the traditional understanding. So last week we talked about the mindfulness of emotions. If you tried putting that instruction into practice, does that make sense to you, or was that helpful for you in your meditation? Yes.
I found it more difficult than the previous two instructions.
Right.
And I'm not sure if it's because of the time of the morning that I'm doing it, 6 a.m. I found it really hard to, sensitize myself to feeling some emotions.
Do you think maybe because the emotions were really quiet, or
possibly, yeah.
Yeah, the instructions of mindfulness is not to go looking for anything. So even though it might seem that way with this progressive way of the classes, it's not to look for anything, but rather to center ourselves on the breath. And then as other things become compelling, then we bring our meditative attention to them. So if emotions are not really strong or compelling or predominant, you know, you could don't know how to focus on it at all.
Just getting worried.
No.
Emotions.
What? Yeah, Alison just said, well, then suddenly you have an emotion to pay attention to. You worry. So you don't have to go looking. Sooner or later, the emotions will visit you. You don't have to, you know. And some people, they'll visit sooner than others. But, you know, there's no need to go looking for something. But when they arise, it's very important to be able to train the attention on those also. Anyone else about emotion? Yes.
I found it really powerful with the emotions, and when I was doing meditation, I guess something happened to me that really kind of scared me. I started getting this kind of loud ringing in my ears, and my hands were really tingling, and then I felt all of a sudden just got like a really strong, like hot flash, and it was a really powerful emotion. It just kind of left me speechless. So I wasn't sure if there was just a lot of emotions that were bottled up that. When I'm not really looking for them, they just kind of came out, but it spooked me a little bit. So I stopped doing it, but I was just wondering if that's normal.
It's normal enough. It's fairly common for people to cover up a part of their life, repress it or push it down or ignore it or whatever, and be so engaged in the surface chatter of our mind that the deeper things, deeper movements of our life don't have a chance to show themselves or come out or resolve themselves. And as people start quieting that surface chatter of the mind, and there's more space for new things to arise, sometimes very powerful emotions can come through, and they can have those kinds of symptoms as you described. And Buddhism is considered to be part of the purification process. Sooner or later, these things need to come out. So, you know, it's better to have them start coming out and resolve themselves and purify themselves than it is to keep them bottled up. So it's quite normal and nothing you need to be afraid of, but it's understandable you would be afraid. Yeah?
I also was paying attention to my emotions, and it was pretty grave. And I ended up with a pain right here. And it lasted for, well, I still have it, and I went to the doctor. And I have a swollen windpipe. Now, I don't know if that has to do with this practice or what, but it's I think I don't know. It's just so now I have these, I have two inhalers and all these different things. But I don't know.
You had a grave emotion. What emotion was that?
Oh, it had to do with the fear of death. And it had to do with envy and resentment and anger. It's sort of like and hatred.
And as you were sitting, that's where you felt that emotion.
Yeah, I sort of narrowed it down.
And could you have any sense that while you were sitting, that you were engaged with those emotions, that you were kind of more not just simply opening to them and being mindful of them, but somehow getting into them?
Well, I was really paying attention to everything that came up, like one by one. And well, there was some amount of separateness from it.
So I don't know what to say, except that our muscles often express our emotions. And so there, you know, different places and different muscles will hold emotions in different ways. And I can imagine. So sometimes, you know, the word anxiety, in the etymology of the word, means to choke. And sometimes people try to control their energy or control the free flow of emotions by holding their breath or holding the throat area kind of tight. And it's possible that, you know, you were doing something like that. It's either that's a long-term event, or it's part of the purification process, or it's also possible that these things started to come up and you resisted it and you kind of clamped down. So you had this. Sometimes what you have is things begin to move, and then a person doesn't really want to let things move, and so they put up a barrier to it in their body. And sometimes you can feel that block. And sometimes the pressure can build quite strongly that way. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's fascinating what can happen when you meditate. Yeah.
I had an emotional reaction to experience that I had this week. Not in a meditation. When I sat down to the meditation, I probably cried for 4 days. And so when I would sit down to the meditation, I would just cry.
Huh?
And it was very difficult to, I didn't want to stop it, and it didn't stop itself. I mean, at times it stopped. And so it didn't come up through the meditation, but it was part of what was happening in my life.
Right. Yeah, so that seems completely fine to sit there and cry. So some people find that it's very helpful to have a meditative space to let those feelings kind of and those crying kind of flow freely without any distraction. And you know, people often in meditation will pay attention to any attempt to try to interfere with that emotion, and so try to get out of the way of the emotion. Just let it flow, and meditation can be quite relieving at the time because it. You just let it flow.
And it was very deep.
Yeah,
I felt it in a very deep way.
Yeah. So I've known people who've cried in meditation for months.
4 days is enough.
Yes.
Is there a difference between thinking of an emotion while you're meditating and actually having the emotion? You treat it any differently?
Well, today we'll talk about thoughts, so maybe they'll help a little bit. But I think generally I would say there's a difference. Thinking about an emotion, which is kind of secondary. It's like you get happy or you get angry, and then you start thinking about the meaning of it, or who you want to tell, or who you don't want to show that emotion to, and there's all this kind of secondary involvement. So in that sense, it's definitely different. However, emotions are component events. They're made up of many parts. They're not just like one unitary thing. And one element of emotions are the thoughts connected to it. So there's thoughts. So, you know, if you get angry, that part of that anger might be the thought of being hurt, you know, and the ideas connected to being hurt by someone. That's part and parcel of the emotion of anger. But then once you're angry, you might then think about the anger. Oh, I'm angry now, and I'm taking this mindfulness class, and I wonder what a good way of, you know, approaching it is. And I don't know if I really want to be present for this anger, you know, and maybe I'll just ignore it today. And so you understand the difference between a thinking process that's part and parcel of it, and that which is secondarily removed. Okay, so let's sit and begin by taking an alert, comfortable posture. Gently close your eyes. And then take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Kind of like from the inside of your body, deep inside, expanding your body as you breathe in, establishing a connection with your body as you breathe in. And then as you breathe out, relax and let go. As you breathe out, let go of any holding in your body. Release yourself to gravity, to your cushion, your chair. And then let your breath return to normal. And sitting here, take a very global awareness of the body. Wide and this broad sense of just sitting here in this body, in whatever way the body shows itself. Feeling the stillness of the body and feeling the various sensations. And then for the next short while, each time you exhale, let's say it this way, let your awareness roam around your body, identifying any places where there might be tension or tightening or holding. Let your attention kind of wander freely around the body, feeling the different places. And then each time you exhale, let there be a little bit of softening or letting go in some area of tightness or holding. And then again, take a kind of a global sense of your body sitting here. There's no right or wrong way to be in your body. Just feel how it is. The sense of presence within your body. And then within the body, as part of the body, become aware of your breathing. And bring an interest to the experience of breathing. Noticing, for example, the difference between the inhalations and exhalation. Which one is easiest for you to do? Easier to breathe in, easier to breathe out? In what other ways does the experience of inhalation and exhalation differ from each other? Are there different sensations that come into play? in addition to the inhalations and exhalation, part of the experience of breathing is a transition from between breathing in and breathing out, between breathing out and breathing in. Some people, there's a feeling of a space or gap, a pause. Sometimes it's just a feeling of switching over one to the other. Let go of whatever thoughts or concerns you might have. There's nothing you need to think about. Just come back to be with your breathing. Staying with the alternating rhythm of breathing in, breathing out. And the idea is to hang in there with your breathing. As if the cycles of breathing are like a wave that you can surf on. You stay and stay riding the waves of the breath, not losing the connection between one wave and the next. The exhalation is a kind of a letting go. Without emphasizing the out-breath in any way, be there for that letting go. Let go of your thoughts, your concerns, your body. Just be there for the letting go of breathing out. with a light touch for the next few breaths. Just watch the process of breathing. Let there be the observation of the experience of breathing in a sustained but light way. Now let go of paying attention to your breath. And as gently as you can, let your attention turn itself to your thinking. When, if you start thinking. And see if you can be the observer of your thinking process. Noticing your thoughts as they occur. Letting there be a kind of light, easy sense of knowing that you're thinking when you're thinking. Easy recognition of the fact of thinking. Many people are so embedded in their thinking that they have no sense of that there's a wider sense of presence or awareness that's outside of the thinking process. With a light, gentle way, can you be outside of your thinking, just recognizing it as it occurring? What happens to your thinking as you watch the process? And then as you're noticing your thinking, I'm going to ask you to pay attention to some aspects of the thinking process which are different than the content of your thoughts, the ideas you're thinking. And the first exploration is to notice something about the quality of that inner voice that carries on the thinking, the inner voice that does the talking. What are some of the qualities of that voice? Is it soft, gentle, harsh, loud, quiet, hesitant, forceful, judgmental, accepting? Is it anxious? At ease? Is it in a hurry? Or is it relaxed? There's no need to judge any things that you notice, but just very gently, the best you can, see if you can study what that inner voice sounds like, as if you're listening to another person, listening to their voice. From a distance, our thinking can seem to be disembodied or kind of like the original virtual reality. But if you're really sensitive, every thinking process you have will have some physical or energetic aspect to it. If thinking is very strong, you might feel like strong energy in your head or pressure or tightness somewhere in the face, the jaws, the shoulders, the stomach. If your thinking is quiet and subtle, the energetics or the physical sensation aspect of them is also quite subtle. As you're sitting here now, noticing your thinking, see if you can notice any physical, any connection with your physical body in that thinking, energetically. Some people's thinking is overheated. For some people, there's a place in their body that they associate with their thinking process. And wherever that place is, there might be some sensation, pressure, tightness, vibration, lightness, exhaustion. Let there be a light touch to your awareness that simply explores these questions, feels your body. If part of your body is getting uncomfortable as you're sitting here, perhaps there's a sense of urgency in your thoughts. How does that translate to physical sensations in your connected to those thinking? And then we'll continue for another couple of minutes. And this time, come back to your breathing. And with that increased familiarity you have with your thinking now, be alert not to get caught up in your thoughts, but to stay connected with your breathing. Let that light touch of awareness stay with the breath, not letting the attention take up residence with any thoughts that come up. Some years ago, I was on a meditation retreat. And in meditation retreats, the schedule usually entails alternating between 45 minutes of meditation, like we usually think of meditation, sitting meditation, and then 45 minutes of walking meditation. Alternates through the day, back and forth. It's a very nice rhythm to do that. And during walking meditation, it's very much like a sitting meditation, where rather than focusing on the breath, we focus on the rhythmic sensations of the legs as we do the walking. The mind wanders off, just come back to the sensations of the legs. And usually the walking meditation is done back and forth. Choose usually a walkway that's about 20 or 30 feet long, and simply walk back and forth. And whenever the mind wanders off, you come back to the feet and the legs and the sensations there. So you're kind of walking back and forth. So I was doing this, I was walking back and forth. And if you walk back and forth, there's some interesting things. Certainly you learn the route pretty quickly. And so you can just kind of relax that part of your mind that has to be concerned about getting someplace and figuring out something. But it was one particular walking meditation period. And I wasn't that mindful. I was actually absorbed in my thoughts. And so I was kind of caught up in my thoughts, my thinking. And I came to the end of my walkway. We have to turn around and walk back. And you walk back over the same path we just walked on a moment ago, but in the other direction. Turn around. And so I turned around, and I took two steps. And then it suddenly occurred to me that now I was standing in exactly the same place, or walking in exactly the same place, where I had been 2 seconds ago. I was maybe facing a different direction, but I was in exactly the same location. And then I didn't exactly literally do this, but it's kind of like I looked around and said, what happened to that thought I had 2 seconds ago in this very location? Because 2 seconds ago, that particular thought that I was thinking seemed so consequential, so important, so necessary. It was like the most concrete thing in the universe, that thought that, you know, that had to be resolved and fixed or whatever. And here I come back to exactly the same location on the earth. Where did it go? You know? And it turns out our thinking is some of the most ephemeral realities on this earth. However, many of us relate to it as if it's really concrete, really solid. There's a very famous line, I mean, not famous, but in our circles, the meditation circles, that an Indian teacher said to an American Vipassana student. He said, not the same as a thing. And we tend to relate to the thoughts we have about something. And so we can get caught up with thoughts about our mother and all that, but that's not your mother. The menu is not the food. But we relate to thought, our relationship to thoughts is very interesting to study. It's very powerful. We tend to be obsessed with our thinking, many of us. And maybe it's the original addiction. It's very hard for us to stop it. But to question, how is it you relate to your thoughts? What's the beliefs, assumptions you have with your thinking? Why is it that the thoughts seem to mask their ephemeral nature? As if we have a thought and we kind of latch on. We think, oh my God. When you think about something and it's just a thought, but then suddenly the body reacts. You tighten up and get worried or get excited or get aroused or whatever the thought might be. What happens with mindfulness meditation is we begin, in a sense, questioning the way we relate to our thinking, and perhaps beginning to develop a new relationship, a new way of being with our thoughts, where we're not taking up residence in our thinking, but rather discover a wider sense of being, a wider sense of presence that's bigger than our thoughts themselves. Our thinking, the Tibetan teacher Chögyam Trungpa once defined that the epitome of the human race, of the human being, is one big traffic jam of discursive thought. So to start noticing our thoughts, to be able to see them, as opposed to live in them, lost in them, and then start noticing something about them that's different than the content of them. So I'm curious what some of you might have discovered as we did this exercise. You focused on your thoughts. Was it difficult, easy, enlightening? Please.
I noticed that the moment I tried to focus on my thoughts, it seemed like there were no thoughts, and that's probably the first time it's happened since I started this practice.
Was that nice?
Yeah, actually, it was really nice.
Until you started thinking about the fact there were no thoughts.
Right, and that was the only thought I had.
Who else found that their thoughts disappeared when you noticed them that clearly? Please.
I had pictures come to my mind. Is that the same as... That's a little different than a thought.
It's a good comment. Some people think more in visually than they do verbally, and so they tend to see more pictures. And so then the instructions to listen to the quality of the voice doesn't quite make sense. Maybe then it's the quality of the filmmaker. Yes?
What was interesting during the session was the difference between the origination of the thought and when I detected I was thinking about the thought. And so what I observed during this session is a little bit more acuity about that period. Like, what bubbles up in the thought, and then how do you pick up stuff with the thought, and how long was that period?
How long of gap was it?
Variable, but short, measured in seconds. But that was the thing that I was most interested in, this kind of bubble below the surface, and then watching it break the surface of the water, and then observing that, and then catching myself and going back down. So it was really not being lost in thought for a long time, and that was in duration between the origination and catching.
Great. When the mindfulness becomes strong, it's possible to feel the bubble beginning to rise, for example, out of that surface of the water. But because you're right there for it, it dissolves before it comes out of the water, and you'll never know what that thought was going to be. You know that you're about to think, but you'll never know, oh, that was maybe the great American novel, and I'll never know. And it's very pleasant to feel the freedom to be able to be right there for the genesis of a thought, and not to latch onto it. Because that's usually what we do, is we latch on. I distinguish between thoughting and thinking. It's not good English, but that doesn't bother me. Thoughting is what the mind does. It's a thought machine. It just produces thoughts. Then what we do is we latch onto the thought, and we have a whole chain of associated thoughts and reactions to the thoughts and thoughts about the thoughts and all that. And in meditation, we're not trying to stop our thoughting, but we want to somehow free ourselves from being preoccupied with the thought, getting caught by the thought, and kind of following that train. It's like the analogy that's sometimes given is actually of a train, that you're sitting there very mindful and you're aware of the trains going by, and there are your thoughts going by, and then at some point we jump on the boxcar and off we go with that train. And we want to try to be on the guard not to jump onto the train, but just stay there, just aware of that, and maintain our freedom in the midst of that thinking process. Other observations, please? What you noticed? Yes?
I had a image come, and while I was sitting here, and several images kind of came and went, but one came up, and I said, I should pay attention to this. Dealing with a building, and thought a good idea that I could use.
Yeah.
And
the great American novel.
So a few times in my life I've actually stopped meditation and written something down, and that made it okay. But this time I just thought, well, it's a good idea, and it'll probably still be there. I wasn't afraid of letting go of it. And eventually I was no longer thinking about it, and I continued on meditation.
Great. I think anyone who continues on a regular basis with meditation will discover points in which their mind becomes very creative. When the normal surface chatter of the mind quiets down, the mind is a little bit still and concentrated, it allows these creative juices to kind of, and insights to kind of bubble up, and they can be very compelling. They can seem really right, really important, you know, and you're going to solve the problems in the Middle East, and you know, you better continue with that train of thought because no one else is going to do it. And it can be very compelling, to these thoughts that we have. And some of them are quite lovely, wonderful, creative, you know, poetry or literature or whatever. And each of you are going to have to kind of sort out what your relationship is to that. Some people who find that it's very difficult to let go of those things because they're so compelling will find it useful to just stop and just jot it down, the idea, so it's not lost. And then once it's jotted down, then they can let go of it and go back to their meditation. My suggestion to you is that process of some creative insight arising is happening because the meditation is going really well. You're involved with a very wonderful process of deepening in the meditation. And by going off on the tangent of the particular idea, you're interrupting that meditative process. And maybe I'm biased, but my opinion is that you're much better off following that the process of meditation to as far as it'll go, than taking a bypass in the direction of some wonderful idea that comes along. So the training is just to let go of that. And no matter how wonderful it is, just let go of it. Yes?
I guess on the same track, I often find that I have insights about myself. Wow. And I think that what you're saying is the same, that the insights about myself are
compelling and even useful, but I'm not quite sure. They're quite difficult to let go.
Yeah. Yeah, I would grant you that they're sometimes very useful. And sometimes it is useful to then stop. If it's really a big shock, you know, and like suddenly a new revelation, maybe it's better just stop sitting and just kind of reflect on that and journal on it or do something and just be with it. But again, I think overall my general policy is just, it's actually much more useful to continue that process that allowed that to arise in the first place and see if you can go even further with it. Usually, I mean, sometimes these personal insights are much more compelling than anything else because we're so self-obsessed. Probably if we studied our thoughts and kind of kept a tally of what percentage of our thoughts were self-referential in nature and how many were not, it would probably be a lopsided event. How about the exploration of the quality of the voice, the tone of the voice? Is that something that made sense to a few of you? You discover something about your voice, your inner voice, that you care to share? Please?
For me, it certainly varies a lot. I mean, often there's a scolding quality to it, and often there's kind of a confiding quality to it. And tonight, I found actually there was kind of a pleasant storytelling quality, kind of a charming. Here's a thought.
Wow.
Quality.
Charming, seductive. Thank you. Anyone else? Please.
Tonight I had a museum guide. It's quite nice, but pretty detached and factual. It's often bossy, but tonight it was a museum guide.
Great. Did it make sense, the idea that you could be the observer of your thinking? That you can kind of, in a sense, kind of be outside of it, watching the process and noticing it? For whom didn't it make sense to do that? It was a completely foreign idea that didn't make any sense. I expect a few of you would have that experience. It's okay to have it. Yeah?
You said thought is ephemeral, so I'd like to know how can you draw on that experience to contemplate impermanence? And also, just thinking, is this thought like, do we have to find, it's almost like it's a dualistic experience too, because whether you think or you don't think. Does that make sense?
The first part made some sense to me about how do you draw on the experience of observing thoughts and noticing the ephemeral nature of them to see impermanence. But I think that to start seeing that thoughts are impermanent will somehow will begin to help us loosen the grip we have on them, to see them as something that arises and passes and is not so solid, not so permanent, makes it easier for us to have a kind of light relationship to them. So,
and then when you say about inner voice, that's like dualistic thinking.
The inner voice.
And then it's like outside me and inside me.
Oh, that way. Oh, most spiritual meditative traditions, Buddhists and others, involve, in a sense, developing our capacity to observe and see. And Buddhists tend not to want to call that the observer. Other traditions, something called developing the observer. Buddhism, we don't want to do that, but the capacity to see and to watch. And, you know, it's okay. Seemingly, the word dualism is a loaded word. And because, you know, in some areas, everything is dualistic is bad. So I'm kind of hesitant to use that word in relationship to this. But in a sense, if we our capacity to know, this awareness, is what heals the dualism. But the awareness has to be used, it has to have something that it's aware of. If we're lost in our thoughts, then you're lost, you're not free. So freedom has to involve some kind of ability to have a wider sense of knowing that's bigger than the thinking itself. And it's very freeing. And it can be very wonderful, really a delight to feel that you're not involved with your thoughts. You know, they're not yours. You don't have to take ownership of them. I mean, one exercise that one teacher recommends is, I imagine, he usually gives this instruction if you're in a meditation hall, but imagine that the display of thoughts and visions that you have in your meditation, imagine that they're being projected from the person behind you. And I think that exercise is meant so you kind of depersonalize yourself. Depersonalize yourself from them. Don't take them so personally. You know, because as soon as we personalize them, it has all these implications about meaning, what it means about me and who I am and what I need to do. And just let the thoughts be free. It can be very relaxing. It's also very helpful to realize in meditation is one of the, maybe the few or the only times in your life where it's very clear, I hope it's clear, that there's nothing you need to think about. There's other parts of life, often we need to think about things, and it's fine to think about things, but there's actually no particular thing that you need to think about when you meditate. What that means is that you don't have to get involved in any particular thought. You can let go of it, or you can just step outside of it. And that, if you get into that, implications of that, can feel like a great relief. Wow, one place in the world. So thoughts, our thinking, is a very important part of our life, and so it becomes a very important area of mindfulness practice. Some people will wait many months, maybe sometimes many years, in their mindfulness practice before they begin including their thinking in the field of mindfulness. This is partly because as soon as some people try to pay attention to their thoughts, they get swept up into the current of thinking. And so they're better off than just staying very simple with a breath in the body and just coming back and learning to let go of their thoughts and come back to the breath. And slowly the mind becomes stronger, the concentration becomes stronger, so that you're not so likely to be swept off by the thoughts that come up when you start paying attention to them. But the full instructions of mindfulness includes learning to pay attention to thinking, because mindfulness is learning to bring attention and awareness and presence to all aspects of our life equally. We don't want to give preference to one area of our life over another, but all areas of our life equally. And in that, thinking is an important part of our life. Part of mindfulness is to become aware of thinking. What that means in meditation is that we mostly focus on the breathing, but when some kind of thinking becomes compelling and we get pulled off, if it's a very light kind of thought that pulls us away from the breath, then you can just let go of it and come back to your breathing. And a very important part of meditation practice, just letting go of those simple thoughts and coming back. And with time, your ability to be concentrated and to let go becomes stronger. But some thinking is not so easy to let go of. It's kind of compelling. It's, you know, you so then the practice of mindfulness is to turn and look at that and become aware of, oh, thinking is happening now. Think, oh, the event of thinking is going on now. And for some thoughts, the very clear acknowledgement and recognition, now I'm thinking, is enough to liberate the thought, to liberate our involvement with the thought. And the thought dissolves. Thoughts only continue through time in the form of thinking if it gets fueled by our involvement. And if we're very involved, if we're completely preoccupied and concerned about this particular thought, we're at the same time fueling and giving it food to live on. But if we simply know it without any involvement, then we're not feeding it. And if a thought which isn't fed tends to just kind of dissolve back into the ether where it came from. So sometimes just clearly acknowledge and seeing that thinking is going on, the thought will just liberate itself. But sometimes our thinking is even more compelling. You can be clearly see it, clearly know you're thinking, and just goes on merrily, thank you, quite strongly. Now, what you want to be careful for here is you don't succumb to the idea that meditation requires you to stop thinking or to let go of your thinking or get rid of your thinking. What we're trying to do is simply to notice what's happening. And if thinking is strong, we're training our mindfulness on noticing strong thinking. Trying not to get involved with the storyline, but just to see the event of thinking. And one of the ways to do that investigation of being present for strong thoughts is to notice something else about that event of thinking that's different than the content. And that's where I was trying to lead you in a little bit. You can notice, if it's very compelling, then there's often energetics as part of it. There's, you know, or some tightening or pressure someplace in your forehead or band around the head or in the center of the head or in the heart or in the chest or in the shoulders or many different places depending on the kind of concern that we have. And if you can ground your attention on the physical aspect of that thinking process, then you're connected to that event of thinking, but you're less likely to get caught up in the ideas. And therefore, you can kind of, you know, be present easier for a longer time. One of the interesting things to explore is if you have a very repetitive theme in your meditation. So even if you can let go of your thought pretty easily, but then the same theme comes up over and over again, then there's usually an emotional component to that thinking process. And then what you investigate, is there an emotion connected to this in the present moment? And sometimes you need to fully acknowledge the emotion. And unless you acknowledge the emotion, the involvement you have with thinking will continue. So the classic example of this is planning. For some people, when they spend a lot of time planning, and they let go of it, and they find themselves planning again, and let go, back to the breath for a few breaths, and they start planning again, it's usually a sign that there's some apprehension, some anxiety, some fear that's operating. And if apprehension is not fully looked at and acknowledged and accepted, then the fear is going to just kind of continue to spit out like a factory of planning thoughts. And it's kind of like those planning thoughts are like flags saying, hey, you dummy, pay attention to me. Meaning to the factory, to the emotion. But most of us pay attention to the thoughts. And they're very compelling. The planning seems really important. I better do it. And that's, you know, part of the nature of our inner life sometimes is to camouflage itself from ourselves. And so this is really important. How important is it? In your meditation, it's not important at all. So don't get fooled. Turn your attention back and feel the emotion. And sometimes you feel the emotion fully, in the way we talked about last week, then sometimes there's no need anymore to keep thinking these planning thoughts or whatever it might be. Some people find it helpful when their mind gets caught up in thinking and they bring their awareness to notice it, to observe the thinking, to very, very quietly name that event. Thinking. Sometimes the naming of something takes away the power of our identification with it. Like the stories of the ancient fairy tales where the dragon loses its power when you know its name or when you name it. Or yes?
When I was sitting with an emotion past week and very strong anxiety came up, and I remembered Thich Nhat Hanh's process, so to speak, of identifying it and acknowledging that calm is also in my body, another emotion is also there as well, even though it's not in the forefront, and then giving it a lot of compassion. That whole process. Would you do that with a scary thought that comes up as well?
In Buddhism, there's a huge repertoire of skillful means for how to relate to things. And certainly, if there's a really scary thought or scary feelings coming up and you feel like overwhelmed, it's sometimes useful to do something like that. And I'd encourage it, if that's what you need to do. However, it's very important to recognize that what you're doing then is not mindfulness. And what you're doing then is trying to cope. or trying to change yourself, or trying to fix it, or trying to make something better happen because you don't like this.
But if that was in the scope of if you're experiencing this during meditation, when you're experiencing it, I found that it's invaluably helpful when I'm in the world and this stuff comes up. And that in the context of meditation, if it comes up, would you do that skillful means practice?
I generally won't. But though sometimes I recommend it for people if things are really strong and they feel overwhelmed by it, by what's going on. It's in the long term, you might find it much more powerful to stay in that very simple place of just being aware of what's happening now, being aware of what's happening now, and not to have any agendas about what's supposed to happen. Many of us are creatures of our preferences. Many of us are the creatures of our fears. Many of us are the creatures of all kinds of values we've learned from society about what it's like to be a good person, a successful person, a right person, or whatever. And so we constantly want to change ourselves or manipulate ourselves or fix ourselves to match some kind of idea of what our preferences are, what our ideas are. And mindfulness works best if you step outside of that entirely. Don't even try to get involved in that. And just, in a very matter of fact, continue the process of knowing what's happening now, knowing what's happening now, not trying to get away from it. That means that when things get really strong, a lot of fear, anxiety, the natural thing is to want to make that better. But the meditative process, mindfulness meditation works, is actually much more powerful if you don't try to make it better. You simply try to learn how to be present in the midst of it. And that, I think in many situations in life, that's the most valuable skill that you can learn. There are situations in life that are really overwhelmingly difficult. And what we need to learn to do is just to be fully present for that event. Someone recently whose relative had horrible kinds of cancer and horrible situations all around. And it seemed like the whole situation was hopeless, and the family level, personal level, health level, and everything. And she was told, maybe what you have to do is just let your heart break. And it was just kind of comment that was kind of said kind of on the side. And she said later that was the most useful thing. Was somehow just to learn how to be really there for that event and not try to always make it fix her preferences and her, all these kinds of things. The modern world meets the meditation teacher. The mindfulness bell of Silicon Valley. Yes?
I'm not sure I can say this, my question succinctly, but I have the experience of getting deeply caught up in thoughts about mathematical problem solving. I guess my first question is, the Buddhist through mathematics, or is that off limits? Because I find that there's a joy in that, and rather than, as you were saying, turning away, trying to fix it, make it better, I find myself trying to turn away and fix it, make it worse, because I'm taking too much pleasure in my thoughts and in the process, and being worrying then that I'm not free because I'm involved in something that I enjoy very much.
Well, that's often the case. People are sometimes very motivated to become free of things which are unpleasant. But why bother becoming free of things which are pleasant? You know, it's pleasant after all. But Buddhism focuses on becoming free. There's nothing in Buddhism that should prevent you from pursuing your wonderful mathematical thoughts. People whose profession is to be mathematicians are expected to think, mathematics. However, in meditation itself, are you free enough in meditation to lay down those thoughts? In the half an hour that you meditate each day, if you do, are you free enough, or are you so captivated by those wonderful equations and possibilities that you're not really in charge? Something else is your compulsion. And so I would say that please continue with your wonderful mathematizing. But see if you, at least in meditation, see if you can discover a mind which is free of that.
I hear that, and I practice that. But the message that I hear that's not being said is the bigger plan is to let go of it altogether. Is that true, or is that not true?
The way we're trying to do in mindfulness is to see clearly what's going on. See really clearly what's going on. That's the bottom line of mindfulness, to really see what's going on. And in the seeing of what's going on, begin letting go of our clinging, our compulsion to what's going on. It doesn't mean we have to get rid of anything except the compulsion, the clinging. So we're not trying to necessarily repress or stop or get rid of anything. But we're also not trying to fuel it or get involved or cling to it or do anything, you know, get actively involved. So there's this, some people think there's only two options: get rid of something or actively engage in it. And the third option for Buddhists is simply to see it and let that knowing that sees it be independent and free of what you know, what's going on. And what I suggested is that, and so the goal of mindfulness is not necessarily to stop thinking, but to see clearly what's going on and no longer be involved with thinking compulsively. And now what happens is generally our thoughts will fade away by themselves if we do that. But it isn't necessarily the point of meditation is to have them fade away. The point of meditation is to see clearly what's going on. And in that seeing clearly, it isn't like you have to do anything extra. In that seeing clearly, we discover our freedom. Yes, please.
The theme of my thoughts seems to be, it's fear-based, and it's waiting to find out what did I forget to do today at work. And a detail-oriented job, so it's a lot of times, you know, amazing things are caught just through thinking about it afterwards. And so I wondered if the Buddhist repertoire for relating to thoughts had anything helpful, particularly helpful for that scenario.
So I would then turn the attention to that fear. And where do you feel that fear in your body, for example?
I think in my breath. I cannot breathe smoothly.
Oh. So don't try to breathe smoothly, but just be fully present for what it feels like to breathe roughly or tightly or constrictedly. And just feel that and be with the fear, be with the anxiety, right there with it, right up against it, just being there with it. And slowly, by doing that, you'll discover your freedom in the midst of it. It'll begin to relax pretty quickly, is my guess. It'll tighten up if you stay involved with those thoughts. But if you... So let's end with a very short sitting. We have tremendous forces inside of us of preoccupation. One of the ways of overcoming that preoccupation is to counter the forces of preoccupation with a gentle, loving, firm dedication to being with the breath. Letting the alternate sensations of breathing in and breathing out be your guide, be your friendly guide that leads you inward to a greater intimacy and stillness within you. feeling the breath, breathing in and breathing out. And as if your breathing were like waves in the ocean, and your awareness is like a cork floating up and down on the waves, let yourself rest in the sensations of breathing. Let yourself float on them, rising and passing, breathing in and breathing out. Let there be a stillness, a silence in the very clear awareness of breathing in and breathing out, in the clear awareness of the body sensations as they rise. Let there be a stillness, a peacefulness in the clear seeing and knowing of an emotion that arises. It's okay for it to be there. Just let the clear awareness of it. And let there be a stillness and a silence that acknowledges and sees thoughts when they arise. For whatever is occurring in the present moment, let that be acknowledged and known and seen from a depth of stillness and silence within you. And then feeling within you if it's possible to find some place or feeling of tenderness or gentleness towards yourself, or just a general feeling of tenderness, gentleness. And now, to end this sitting, instead of watching your thoughts for the next few seconds, think thoughts of goodwill towards yourself. Have some thoughts of wishing yourself well. Have some thoughts that are kind towards yourself. And then you can take a couple of deep breaths, let go. Thank you very much, and next week we'll have our last class in the 5-week series, and I wish you all a wonderful week. Thank you. And there are handouts in the back. I brought some extras from the previous weeks in case you didn't get them.